It was a very challenging environment. But I'm not going to steal your thunder. Yeah, Jan, everybody in this room wants to know a little bit about your journey at Eskom, a journey that came to an end in July 23. And you are now the chairperson of a renewable energy play, Mulila.
Mulila, yeah.
So let's just go back, if I can, take you perhaps to a darker place.
My marriage. Sorry, Vicky. Thanks, Bronwyn. And really, thank you for the opportunity. I was very blessed. My dad used to work 25 years for Eskom. So I grew up in an Eskom house, so to speak. It wasn't an Eskom house, but I grew up in an Eskom house. I was an Eskom bursar. Chris is sitting there. We were at university together. Then I did my national service, so I studied engineering. Did national service, and I think Kofi is here as well. There he is. We did national service together. And then I started with Eskom for 26 years. So my first life in Eskom was 26 years. I was very blessed. I worked throughout the value chain, distribution, transmission, generation, and then a bit of research, test and development. And when I left Eskom after the 26 years, I was responsible for the group Capital building Medupi and Kusile and Ingula. So, and then also, perhaps I can mention that I was also blessed to have been given the responsibility for electrification in the mid-90s. So because of some reasons, one of it, I couldn't accept the decisions that were made in 2008, which Eskom is still paying for now in terms of Kusile and Medupi. I decided to leave Eskom. So for 10 years, I was on my own, being a contractor, worked in Africa, etc. But I think the important thing is I learned what life is all about outside Eskom and how important is a bottom line and how important people, how important they are. Then I got the call from the Eskom board in 2018, to come back as a group chief operating officer. And Lindy will tell you, it took me about 5 weeks to make up my mind. And what they told me during the interview, what I can expect in Eskom, but it wasn't even a fifth, even a tenth of what I experienced when I walked back. It was a different company. I grew up in Eskom, worked 26 years for. And my dad, you 25 and me 26, and we walked back into an organization that is foreign, completely foreign. Significant challenges, really. So be it, you know. We tried our best to see how we can ensure energy security in the country. And you know, I suppose we will talk about my view of the challenges in Eskom, but because of the challenges, significant challenges in the organization, it was difficult to make a quick stride forward. And then, obviously, when we were there, let's talk about myself. It was very quickly for me to identify that the big issue that we have is no maintenance have been done. Now, if you have an old car, I started using the example of an old car. If you've got an old car, 15, 20 years old, and the only thing you do is you put in fuel, you pump the tires, you put in water in the radiator, and when you get in the car, the foot is on the accelerator, right? So you get whatever you can out of it. And then the best of all is, let's assume, and please, I have nothing against any car make. If you drive a Mercedes or whatever, Datsun, whatever the case may be, and if that's what you have and somehow it breaks down and you need to take it in, you don't take it to a Mercedes dealership. You take it to anybody. When you have somebody working at it, and thanks to black economic empowerment policies. Nothing wrong with the policy, but the outcome nobody understood. And then when you have somebody working in your car, it's not a qualified Mercedes mechanic, it's anybody. And when you put in spare parts, not Mercedes spare parts, it's any part. And you know from which country I actually mean. So that's what I found when I got back. Significant challenges. And if you take a power station, is designed to run for about 50 years. And if you take Medupi and Kusile out of the equation, on average, the power plant, the 12 power plant, coal fire power plant that is left, is in excess of 44 years old. Abused, not maintained. So this is what I found when I got back into Eskom. And then, geez, I walk in there and the only thing on my table is voluntary separation packages. I said, but I don't understand it. No, we've got to transform. So I said, I understand transformation and I fully support transformation. But again, if you don't understand the successful outcome of transformation, and there's nothing wrong with that, and it's about numbers, you've lost it. So these were the things that I found when I arrived.
Was broken by the time you got in the second time?
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. You know, one of the five issues that I've identified in Eskom that is significant is criminality and corruption. It was, and I believe it still is, a free-for-all. Lots of people, and outside and within Eskom, it is not about 61 million people of the country. It's not about their lives and the economy of the country. It's about their own pockets. So the rule of law was a significant challenge that we had to deal with. And, you know, if you stand on a water pipe, and my wife can bear me out, they will do whatever they can to get you off that pipe. That's why I had 9 forensic investigations in the time that I was there, which I couldn't find anything. So it was a difficult situation.
9 forensic investigations, did you see for your life? I sound like Annika Larsson.
Yeah, she phoned me after Andre's interview and wanted my story as well. But somehow I had sense. A lot of people ask me if you read Andre's book. I said no, and I'm dead serious. Why do I need to read something that I was part of? The day that Andre was poisoned, he phoned me. He said, Jan, where are you? I don't know where I was. I wasn't at the office. And he said, I think I've been poisoned. So I said, about what? What do you think it is? He said, I can only think it's coffee. He at the office. Because I got nauseous, et cetera, after I had coffee. And even myself had a lot of coffee. But to come back to your point.
Well, no, wait. He phoned you and he said he'd been poisoned by the coffee.
He believed so, yeah.
And then what?
He said to me, be very, very careful, because he was aware of all the death threats and other threats that I have received in my tenure at Eskom. One of it specifically was Boss Baird. You know, our oldest son is autistic. He's 31 years old, turning nearly 32 now. And that the guy that gave the threat said, you've got an autistic son. This is how old he is. This is what he drives. This is the time he leaves your house. All these sort of things. Your middle son, this, yes, this. So we strongly recommend you stop investigating. So these things did happen. Did I worry about my life? No, I was very blessed. I had 3 personal security friends that looked after me. Wherever I went, wherever I had to go to, they were making sure that everything was fine. So I never felt threatened at all. Obviously, I'm a Christian and I believe in God. And I've given it to him. He's put me back in Eskom to make a difference. And I believe that he will look after my safety and see that I do what I need to do.
What was the final nail in the coffin for you? Given what you just said, that you felt it was a calling, that you could make a difference, but you made that call whether it was your involvement in Mudupi, Kusile.
Bronwyn, in November 22, when Kyle Cohen couldn't keep his mouth, now it's News 24, and he had to say, I'm going to go on pension. But he didn't say, you know, in Eskom, when you turn 65, you have to go on pension. So it became a big issue. And it also landed on the table of President Ramaphosa. So he invited me to his house one Sunday morning, a couple of months after that, just before I left. And we had a long discussion, him and myself, for about 2 hours, just the two of us in his house. And at the end, you know, after I spoke to him for quite some time, he said, Matt, Jan, I want you to stay.
Did he not say, I want you to run?
No. During the discussion, I made it clear I'm not interested. He did ask me who I believe should run Eskom, which I gave him my views. I'm not going to tell you.
Jan, you cannot throw us breadcrumbs like that and not go any further. Who do you believe should run Eskom?
That someone that has... Let's come back to André de Ruyter. And I'll answer your question by saying what I'm saying now. André de Ruyter was, in my view, became very good friends and business colleagues. So he was an exceptional businessman, make no mistake. The shortcoming he had, he was a lawyer. I'm not saying lawyers are a shortcoming, but from a technical point of view, he had some challenges, although he did fairly well in my view. I believe he started getting a team together that if we were left alone to do what we believed was what we had to do, I believe we would have moved positively forward. So whoever you put in there, and you know, Dan Morokane that started now, I don't know him from a bar of soap. In the 10 years that I left Eskom, between my first and second life in Eskom, he was there, so I don't know him. But I wish him, really, I wish him well. But I just trust that he will be supported and not dictated to what to do.
So Mteto Nyati is sitting as chairman. Do you know Mteto?
I've met him when he was appointed, in the last board meeting, yes.
They're going to have to work very closely together.
Absolutely. I have respect for Mteto. But I can recall when the new board was appointed, you know, they had their own views, which I respect. And it was, let's quickly fix this. It is now going for 2 years. It is not an easy situation. It's a very complex business. It's a business that 20, 22 years ago, when it was voted by its peers in the world as the best utility in the world, to get back to that, I believe, is not possible for various reasons. So I just trust that sanity will prevail, because in my view, the Eskom of the past is gone. As a matter of fact, when I was reappointed in Eskom in July 18, after 2-3 months, the board asked me at the time to come back and say, can we fix Eskom? And I started off by saying, you know, what you told me and what I've experienced is chalk and cheese. And I said to him, you cannot fix Eskom. You've got to split it. You've got to cut it apart. And André came in and he did quite well. It was my view that you have to take the generation, transmission, and distribution and make it separate units, each one, you know, with its own focus. Because when I arrived back, Eskom was a black hole. Finances, procurement, everything. Nobody was accountable. I heard now. That this VGBSE report now is actually highlighting that as well, which was true. What a power station manager did, nobody knows when I arrived. To give you an example, I arrived back, and my induction back, my second life in Eskom, was Pakomani Khadebe is going overseas to go and get money, and I'm acting a week after I rejoined, 10 years ago. Industrial action and load shedding. So that was my induction back in Eskom. So The issues, what came to my table in that first 2-3 weeks, just to demonstrate that there was no accountability at a power station level for the power station manager. I got the feedback that at one of the power stations, the people were just running in and out. Security systems didn't work. The turnstile didn't work. I picked up the phone. I phoned the power station managers. Why is it not working? No. First, I said, what is happening? He said, the turnstile is not working. I said, I know. That's why I'm phoning you. I said, why is it not working? He said, sir, please talk to security at Megawatt Park. Another occasion, no fuel oil. No fuel oil is like blitz. So you at the power station, you take coal, you grind it, you make it a powder, and then you have, you know, fuel oil like blitz, and you get it going. You heat up the pipes and the water in the boiler. No fuel oil. What? I phone the power station. I said, why have you no fuel oil? He said, sir, please phone procurement at Megawatt Park. This is what I found going back.
So these deep, deep operational inefficiencies.
Absolutely. But it was planned. Make no mistake, it was planned that they could loot. That's what it was all about.
So we've built this session as the timeline it will take to fix Eskom, the capital it will take to fix Eskom. I know from boardrooms in South Africa, everybody is latching on to what you are saying in terms of the generation, transmission and the distribution and breaking up the organization. Is this what is actually going to happen? I want to go into solution mode here.
Sure. It depends on the shareholder. The owner of the business. The owner of the business appoints a board, please manage this company on my behalf. Board then appoints management. Please, we're not there daily. Please manage on a daily basis. But the strings are still pulled by the owner of the business, obviously with inputs. Now, my view is, yes, we need to move towards getting separate legal entities as soon as possible. And I believe what is important to understand is that generation, Eskom generation, the generation of the past will not be the generation of the future. It will be one of the generating companies in the future. It will only be one of them. And it's one of my failures in my tenure. And I really feel bad about it. I thought about it a long time, you know, how could I have done it differently? But I couldn't get it into a power station manager's head that you're actually running a massive business. Your input cost is there. If you do anything or nothing, it is there. You've got to pay people. You've got to pay fuel, et cetera, et cetera. And if your unit is not producing, there's no flipping money coming in. And if there's no money incoming, you're running a loss. I couldn't get it over that you're actually running a business. So I believe this is a way we should be going in South Africa as soon as possible. And this is why I've decided to make a positive contribution as best as I can, still within the South Africa energy sector, by generating additional electrons and to contribute positively to the lives of the 61 million people of the country. So I believe that the transmission company will remain as is for the time being. That's the way I see it. Because they need to understand what is the supply after demand, number one, and where is the supply going to come from. So I think that is fine. You know, that needs to be a single unit. But it needs to be run by professionals and a professional board. Then, as I said, generation, in my view...
When you say it needs to be run by professionals and a professional board, are you inferring that the current structures are not going to yield the appropriate results?
I believe we need to relook what we are doing and how we're doing it. We also need to make sure that we have competent and skilled people that will take us forward. We have started on the process, and the shareholder, which was Minister Gordhan at the time, supported the fact that we become three legal entities with three separate legal independent boards. So I believe we've started the transition. I just believe that we need to continue doing so.
timelines?
How long is a piece of string? It is a difficult question. You know, I was listening to Ian Cameron just now before lunch, and he was talking about purpose and talk about hope. I believe that the lack of policy in the sector has put us on the back foot. So we are reacting on whatever is happening. It's a reaction from whatever needs to happen. And I believe that policy needs to take a significant focus, that we get on the front foot and that we don't react to things that is actually costing us an arm and a leg. So to answer your question is a difficult one, Bronwyn. How long is it going to take? It is definitely not going to take building a nuclear power station. I've heard this on the news and I couldn't believe what I'm hearing. We're going to build a nuclear power station. It's going to get us out of load shedding. I don't know, you heard it as well. Now, I don't think we've got 10 years to wait, because that's how long it takes to build a power station, a nuclear power station. So I believe we just need to understand what the demand in the country is and the profile. So it's one thing to say this, and we need 10 gigawatts more, whatever the case may be. It's also to understand what is the profile that is required. We also need to understand what is the technology that is coming. How is that going to change, you know, the demand and the profile? And only when you have a good understanding of that, then to go back and say, what do we need? So if you ask me, it is going to take some more time. And
I don't want to interrupt you there.
Okay. And this is why I believe, Bronwyn, that we need urgently to look at a regional solution beyond the borders of South Africa as well. If you look what is happening in Europe, you know, those countries are all connected. So, and I believe that's where we need to go. Because we have a South African power pool, a transmission system that is integrated to some extent, a lot of work needs to happen. But this will help if we have a regional view, that we will also then be able as a region to assist ourselves in whichever country to deal with the energy security challenge that we have.
Do we have the leadership within the region to make this work any more than we have the dearth of leadership to make it work within our own economy?
I've been approached by, and I'm not going to tell you which country it is. I've been approached by a country asking me to come and assist because they are fully cognizant of the fact that the lack of energy security is costing the country an arm and a leg. I've also been approached to assist by looking at the Zambezi. You know, that water is running all the time. So why don't we utilize it by means of pump storage, by means of hydro? So I believe
the country's not Zambia.
No, it's not. No, it's not. But I unfortunately believe it's going to take time. You know, and also, although I am assisting now in a renewable company, is that the solution? No, it's not the only solution. And this is why I cannot emphasize enough this demand picture to understand it, because it doesn't mean sun and wind alone. You need a hybrid solution to deal with the challenges that you have and to ensure that that demand and the profile that you need is addressed. I am amazed that we haven't moved forward with pump storage in the country, with gas in the country. Those are the things that we need, because it's part of a hybrid solution to make sure that your demand, this profile, what you need, is effectively addressed.
I want to open to audience questions. So great, hands up, fantastic. We'll get the mic there. As we get the mic to the first gentleman, just in terms of South Africa's solution, you've tabled it. Piet Viljoen yesterday on stage was part of the opportunity from an investment thesis perspective in the country is that public sector is not working and private sector is coming in and filling the gap. Most boardrooms, and you take something like the hospital group, Netcare, they've come in and provisioning their own energy resources. We're seeing Discovery do the same. Many of the private sector players are coming forward and saying, we're not waiting for the public sector to solve this. I mean, it could actually be that Eskom becomes irrelevant in the overall ecosystem. Not irrelevant, it'll always be there, but the private sector will prevail and that will make the transformation that we need.
Yeah, Bruno, come back what I said earlier, I agree with that. Eskom will definitely not be relevant in time to come. They will have their role to play. And they have a significant role to play. They have what we need to understand in the next 15 years, max, 20 gigawatts, half of the generation capacity that is generated by means of burning coal will come to end of life. And that is base load capacity, 365, 24/7. And this is why I'm talking about a hybrid solution. So, but there will at least be six of these massive big power stations remain, Medupi and Kusile, up until 2050. So they will still play a significant role. But this is why I say they will be one of the generation companies in future and private.
It's the hybrid that you're talking to. So,
yeah, you've just been touching on my question. So I read an article recently, I don't know about the exact details, but South Africa's got a capacity of plus minus 55 gigawatts, of which about 44 is Eskom and the rest is private. In 2022, I think 2.5 gigawatts of renewable energy projects was approved. In 23, it was nearly 6 gigawatts. I know it's complicated to get it into the grid, but is that not, if that trajectory continues, is that not part of the solution?
It will be part of the solution, not in the solution. Over the last 18 months, 19, 20 months, let's make it over the last 20 months, we doubled, more than doubled the PV on the rooftops. The last year alone, 2 gigawatts alone. But the challenge that we have moving forward is for the system operator to ensure the integrity of the network going forward. Because all of a sudden you bring energy and you take capacity away. And it's to fully understand, because your network always have been designed for base load capacity. So it's something else that we're bringing in now. And then also another challenge that we have, although these bit windows are now getting momentum, flipping so late. I'll come back to this now. So there's another significant challenge that we have in the country over and above generating electrons. It is to those electrons that we're generating, how do we get it to the load centers? Because all of a sudden now, where's the sun shining? Where's the wind blowing? It's where we don't have transmission infrastructure. This is why you find now, and we are dealing with that where I am now, we are ready. We've got the investment, so we're ready to move forward and build the power plant. But there's grid capacity constraints on the Eskom side. So that's another challenge that we have. And the point that I wanted to make, and let me make it, on the 9th of December 2019, the first time we had stage 6 load shedding in the country, I'll never forget it. 2 days later, I had to look the president, the deputy president, the minister of DMRE and DP and ICE, and I had to tell them that this, what was happening. And the president, and that's when I started using the example of the car. So the deputy president afterwards said to me, so Jan, what are you telling us? We need a lot more new cars. And I said to him, spot on. You must remember, if you have a system that is so unreliable and so unpredictable, and it's not enough, How do you take those units off and maintain and fix them for 2, 3, 4, 5 months, whatever is required, while you need it? So you need additional new cars. And there I said, the president then said, Jan, how do we make sure it doesn't happen again? And I said to him, Mr. President, and he, these were my words. You can go and look it up. I said, Mr. President, we urgently need 4,000 to 6,000 megawatts of capacity. The day before yesterday, those were my words, more than 4 years ago. And I said, if not, stage six will be part of our lives going forward. Now, the question that you ask is, the policymaker was sitting there and the implementer was sitting. So why is it taking so long? So it's really challenging. So that's why I say we are reactive.
Jan, thank you for your insights and for the work you've done in the past. You've spoken a lot about structural issues. What about the actual culture at Eskom? It seems like it's a culture of mediocrity and non-accountability. How do you actually change that?
Yeah, that's a good point. We've got exceptional people working within Eskom. Make no mistake. If you ask me today, what do I miss from my days in Eskom? It's a people. Incredible, exceptional people. However, how do you get 20 years of experience? It's simple. You've got to work for 20 years. And you need a coach and you need a mentor. Simple. And by... remember what I said earlier, voluntary separation packages, this is what I got when I arrived. So let's just get rid of all the flipping experience and competence that we can get the numbers sorted out. Without understanding, Eskom is a complex business. So you let go the mentors and the coaches and the experience, and you bring in young people with all the talent, all the potential in the world. But don't you sit them on the back foot immediately. So, I believe that we have a significant, and this is Jan's view, human capital challenge within the organization. And it's going to take time to get those wonderful colleagues. And I'm telling you, they've got all the potential and just all the talent in the world to get them to a level that they can take accountability and understand what they do. You know, why did the good Lord, you know, let us be born as babies, and then you crawl, and then you walk, and then it's a process. To work is exactly the same process, in my view. So there is a morale challenge. And you know, there was a time I can remember in my first life in Eskom, when you walked in public and you had an Eskom badge, you know, geez, you were proud. Everybody was talking about it. Now you don't even put a blazer on like that anymore. And this is why whenever I go around, even now, I'm asking people, don't crucify Eskom. Eskom's got their own problems, their own challenges, make no mistake. But a lot of the decisions made in the past, and perhaps still in a way being made, getting Eskom where it is now, not about the good people there. They're trying their utmost. But yes, I believe that Eskom has a moral challenge.
Go ahead, sir.
Can I ask you a question now, but I only want you to finish it right, answer it right at the end. That shows I've got the microphone in my hand. Ramaphosa has said this week that by the elections, his position as a minister will be redundant. Fact or fiction?
I read it as well.
Ahead with your question.
Thank you. Why would Eskom take Frankfurt to court for trying to get power, essentially? Why? It doesn't make sense to the average man in the street.
Yeah, it's something that I cannot comment on. I believe perhaps, and I'm just trying an answer, and it's only my personal view without understanding the reasons. It may be because when you work for Eskom, you think about Eskom. You perhaps not think about the bigger picture. I've been pushing now for the last 2 years, even the last year that I was in Eskom, you asked me a question, I haven't answered you. What was enough? That we need to build...
That's not a very good signal.
Yeah, you said that.
It's very...
No, it's fine. My wife will tell you. The issue of having Eskom in a good year built 300 kilometers of transmission line. 300. We've got to build 14,000 in the next 12 years. Now, I'm saying, please, let's change the model that Eskom has been building these lines all along. You cannot do 1,200, 1,400 kilometers. You cannot do it. So open it up to the market. Change it. Like a concession, you know. Tell whoever want to participate with a bag of money, that's the way we want this line. We will look how you're going to build it. We will have all the necessary controls. You can own it. You can maintain it, but we will operate it. And in 20 years, you know, monthly, we will pay you this and you can get it back. I cannot get Eskom to understand this. And that's the point that I want to make. They think, I believe, I'm Eskom. You know, we can do it. And perhaps not seeing the big picture.
My brother farms on the Fisher River irrigation scheme. They're having a terrible trouble with unpredictable load shedding and their center pivots. About 10 kilometers away, the Fisher River tunnel comes into a portal with a generating chamber bigger than this room, with one generator in place and all the mountings for another one. It's never, ever been switched on in 50 years. Does Eskom know about it? And what's the chances of something happening there? It's been ready to go for 50 years.
In my years with Eskom, the last 5 years, I was not aware of it. In the Fisher River, I was not. I was aware of four of them, small little hydros in the former Transkei. But no, I was not aware of this. Yeah, I was not aware of this. If you want to, you can give me the information and I'll make sure. Yeah, please do.
Go ahead, David. Another mic there. Sue.
Jan, Medipi and Kasila really should be doing the heavy lifting for us right now. And I know in your channel there were design issues that you were going through units one at a time to try and sort out the design issues and get them up to speed. I mean, these are two incredibly important projects for us right now. They should be doing the heavy lifting and they need to be doing the heavy lifting for the next 20 years. When you left there, did you sort out had you got to the bottom of the design issues and will those units continue to deliver close to design capacity on a sustainable basis? Did we solve those design issues?
I believe that we have solved the design issues. If you look at specifically Medupi, so we have installed all the design modifications on all six units. We've also done it at Kusile. Now, if you look at the performance, with the exception of Unit 1 when we blew up that generator, and again, that was because of inexperience. But if you look at the five units at Medupi, they are performing exceptionally well. The energy availability is in the 80%, so it's going well. But there's no fluidized gas desulfurization unit taking the sulfur out of the air. But it has to be installed. That's a World Bank requirement. If you look at Kusile, there you have this plant installed, and that is what created a significant amount of the challenges within Kusile. This is why we had that duct failure in units number 1, 2, and 3, where we couldn't use that smokestack anymore. We had to build 3 new temporary stacks. If you look at unit number 4, we've actually asked the original equipment supplier, you run it for a period of 6 to 8 months. The energy availability was 80%. Comes back to the point, I believe that Eskom needs to invest in the most important asset of the organization, its people, much more. So those units, in my view, sorting out this the FGD operation, if we can do that, and we got to implement it at Medupi, those two big units, which is nearly 5,000 megawatts apiece, will perform extremely well. But I believe it depends on who's going to operate and maintain it. Excellent plots.
Right, Jan. Your view on Guedi's 20 billion love affair with the top
car power ships. Is that another arms deal? And does Eskom have to be on its knees before you can get it signed?
The president asked me the same question. And I'll give you the same answer. My view is where the country finds itself now, we need to look at it. There's no doubt about it. It's much cheaper, even though it's hell of expensive, than load shedding that we have in the country and what it's doing to the lives of the people. However, what I said, please, let's not sign 20-year deals. Let's sign a 3 or 5-year deal and let's have some understanding on what we're going to pay for the input, which is the gas. So I believe that is definitely something that we need to look at to get through the challenge that we have. However, if you do that, let's at least have plans. What do we do in the meantime?
Put it where?
Go ahead.
Jan, with regards to wheeling, and specifically if you consider the fact that private generation is probably a key part of the solution going forward, and then using Eskom's transmission capability to get it to clients elsewhere. Mm. We all know that wheeling takes place on the Eskom to Eskom level, where clients are on the Eskom network instead of municipal level. The challenges that we face on municipal level to get wheeling properly working in the country, how do you see that play out and getting fixed?
First of all, we need to make sure that we have sufficient electrical networks in place. That is critical. And if we have that in place, our policymaker needs to start getting, in my view, perhaps not the act together. There's perhaps a more positive way of saying it, but let me leave it there. And getting these tariffs implemented, that if we wheel and if there's sufficient capacity on that network, what are you going to pay for that? So I believe traders and wheeling is something of the future coming in. So it may be where Eskom will buy directly, or they will generate themselves and get the power wherever they want to. They wheel it through their own electrical networks. Or number two, they will buy it from an IPP and then get it to their customers. Another option is an IPP will then go directly to a customer. But in order to do that and not having access to its own network, electrical network, they will have to wheel it via Eskom, provided there's sufficient capacity. Or you can have a trader that is the in-between. So it is something that needs to take place going forward. And I believe that not a lot of attention, my view, is given on this currently. And it has to. Because this is something that's come to stay. Trading of electricity is coming. It's perhaps not here yet, but it's coming. There's no doubt. And the wheeling of electricity on whatever network is available is a given. But the challenge that we in South Africa have, we do not have it sufficient electrical networks throughout the country. And to get the power generated wherever in South Africa to the load centers where it's needed. I'm sure some of you do have some farms. If the Eskom bucky stops there, now think about this. Now you and the wife or you and the husband are sitting there every night having a glass of coffee, whatever. And you look at the beautiful sunset or sunrise, whatever you want to call it. And it's just picture perfect and life is perfect. The next day the Eskom bucky stops there. So, madam, will you please sign here? We want to build a transmission line. All right. Are you going to sign? I don't think so. So there are some significant challenges. Sorry.
Yeah. Mine. Yeah. Very insightful discussion you've had here. My big takeaway so far, and I'm talking from engineer to engineer, Eskom's got a cultural problem, no doubt. And I always think of the Jim Collins book, From Good to Great. And Eskom was one of the greatest utilities in the world. Now it's gone from great to, I don't know, let's say poor. Is it not the remuneration policies that were actually put in a few decades ago where there was a maximization of return on assets? In other words, trying to turn it into a profit-generating entity. Because, I also running businesses. You always got a balance between investing in CapEx and your maintenance. And the thing that came through to me now is there wasn't any money or not much money spent on maintenance all these years. And you can never fix it unless you start replacing the plant. So was that not the start of the rot that came into Eskom? The lack of, well, the KRAs was to maximize profit as opposed to maximize the longevity of the equipment. Just a question.
I believe it may have been one of the contributing factors, absolutely. I want to come back to the people. Eskom has got, and I'll never stop saying it, it's got some exceptional people. I believe that Eskom, what they're doing extremely well, is they remunerating people extremely well. There has been some challenges, especially for the leadership in terms of annual increases, etc. But I believe in general, Eskom is paying its people extremely well. Some decisions were made in the past that the country is paying dearly for. There is no doubt about it. And I don't believe that some of the decisions made in the past was perhaps focusing on to improve the lives of 61 million people in the country, but maybe some other agendas that I'm not aware of. There are people making decisions in Eskom that I believe is looking after the well-being of the economy in the country, but I don't believe it's always there.
Yes, go ahead. I know you've been...
Jan, thank you. You've spoken a lot about the complexity, the technical, the maintenance, and I read a lot into what's been said, the lack of fit for purpose. But in the end, there's also a big funding gap. And we have a culture, not only in Eskom, as to the exorbitant procurement and corrupt process heard and read about, but our South African consumer that is entitling themselves to using Eskom generated power and not paying therefore. What is the view of the Eskom executive of the board policy that this cannot continue? We've got municipalities that own, Eskom billions and billions of rands, and yet we paying consumers are faced with the annual call for increase in tariff, and yet there is this big lack of policy making, or I don't want to call it a big stick, but certainly this can't continue.
Sure. If you have a business and you owe people 400 billion rand, then you have significant challenges. There is no doubt about it. And then with your sometimes limping generation plant, you still produce electrons and through your network and you provide it to customers and some of them don't pay for it, then it becomes challenging. So all of a sudden your cash flow is becoming a significant challenge. There are five big issues in Eskom. In my view, the one, human capital, we've spoken about. The second one is finance, exactly what you're talking about. Because we still need to pump to get the economy to pump. So we need to assist Eskom wherever we can. So it's a difficult one. The third one being asset management. And with asset management, I mean all assets. Then the fourth one is additional capacity. And the fifth one being the criminality and corruption. I believe those are the five big issues. Now, to come back to the finance one, I was vocal, and I'm just going to give it again in general, and I'm not going to answer anything. But I said, is it possible for government, perhaps, to take away Eskom's financial obligations, annual financial obligations? And because Eskom's making a 30 billion rand EBITDA operating profit. So at least then there's money that you can take the money and you can maintain your plant. And plant mean not only generation, but all your plant, transmission and distribution as well. Now, fortunately, last year, the Minister of Finance then came forward and he said, Eskom, I'm going to take away your financial obligations, if you can recall, for 3 years, 240, 50, 60 billion, I don't know what it is, because it's no use. You make a 30 billion profit, and as soon as you need to pay everybody that you owe money, you make a 30 billion loss. But the Minister of Finance made it very clear, however, if I do this, you will not borrow another cent. So it was my understanding now, Eskom has 30 billion that they will invest. But now I see they burn it everything on diesel. Some of you will be happy. But now, if you look, I would venture that Eskom's bill, the bill for running open cycle gas turbines this year is going to be at least 36 billion rand. So the money that was available is perhaps now utilized for something else. And then you need to ask the question, so why are we burning diesel? Why don't we convert to gas? I owe you an answer.
Jan, I'm going to take a final question from this gentleman, then we will close with your question. Well, partially close, and then we will close with my question.
Wuchat.
Jan, I'm going to go back to something you said earlier on, that you see the solution looking at a regional, but we know Rakana is going through a drought, so they're done. We know Mozambique, the contract's coming to an end, so they want their power back. That doesn't leave you with much, much more leeway in terms of the South African vis-a-vis regional. So doesn't that sort of take the feet out from your possible solution?
Those, I agree with you. However, the whole of Zambezi is running there. So I believe there's a potential that we need to benefit from. There's gas in Mozambique, second to none. So it is not to get the gas here, but why don't we get transmission lines that have come here or connected to a South African power pool? So I believe there, and the Congo has a lot of water. So yes, there are isolated areas that perhaps is not going to have a positive contribution. But I believe there are so many others that we haven't sort of given the attention and the focus in the region that we actually can. And I believe that people with the experience need perhaps to stick up their hands and say, I'm prepared to make a contribution.
I think you need to remind us of your question.
No, I know it.
You know it.
Ramaphosa. I read it as well, where Minister of Electricity said he believes by the end of the year you'll be out without a job, because then load shedding will be something of the past. That's what I read. And you know what I read, and what somebody's actually said, you know, there's always something there. So, because, you know, Lindy, my wife, she's looking at news and Cliff and social media. I don't. And the thing is that people are saying what I've said and et cetera, you know, it's chalk and cheese sometimes. But should that be true, and load shedding is a thing of the past, which I respectfully cannot see. Respectfully, I cannot see that. But should it be true, then I'll take my hat off to the Minister of Electricity if he's saying, I'm standing back, I've done my job.
And my final question?
Why did I leave? I thought you were going to ask it again. After the meeting, or during the meeting, at the end of the meeting with the President, it's difficult to say no, you know, all the time to him. But I was, when he said to me, please, I'd like you to stay, because 2 days before it, he sent his advisor and I said no. So he said, I'd like you to stay, and I said no. And I gave him 5 minutes why it's time for me to go. And And I was done. He was just looking at me and he said, "You're done?" I said, "Yes, Mr. President." He said, "I would like you to stay." So I then agreed, okay, I'll stay, but not as group operating officer, chief operating officer. I will focus on Kusile, you know, where we had the chimney challenges, and then I'll focus on Coburg. And that's exactly what I then did after I retired formally. But this was in the middle of July, up until I said, no, I had enough. There were 4 additional forensic investigations against me. None with any substance. You know, the one I'm sure you've read was Fidelity Guards. Remember the $500 million thing? Rubbish. Everything has been signed, approved at board levels. So, and it wasn't $500 million, it was $280 million. Then there was 2 others, but the one that broke the camel's back was, you know, I got an email from wherever saying in Eskom, "We just inform you there will be another forensic investigation against you for you approving a company that will investigate corruption. They want to investigate me forensically because I have appointed somebody to investigate in May 2018, while I only joined in July 2018. So then I said, I had enough. I had enough. Let me rather than try my utmost to... You know what I haven't told you? What is my purpose in life? Do I have a minute?
You do. Indeed.
It took me, Bronwyn, as a young man, it took me, I didn't understand why did the good Lord put me here, you know, what is my purpose in life? And as I said earlier, I was very blessed to have headed up electrification in the mid-90s. And I can remember we were sitting it was either a Friday afternoon or Saturday, I can't remember. It's late afternoon, we've electrified a village. It was in the beginning of electrification. And they're close to Groblersdal. Christian, you know, Groblersdal, Marlborough, somewhere around there. And this chief, we said to him, "You talk. When it gets dark, you know, then you stop and then we're going to switch on the lights." And this guy was just getting on and on and on and on. And eventually, you know, we caught his eye and piped out. So he piped down and we had a little breaker here mounted on a little pedestal and put on this breaker. And when he put on the breaker, we should put on the links here at the back. And all of a sudden, it was just lights. And, you know, the uncles and the aunts and the children, everybody was shouting and screaming and laughing and crying, and I was just sitting there becoming extremely emotional, and I still do thinking about it. And just here I realized what is my purpose in life, and that is to make a positive contribution in the lives of others. And this is why I still carry on, and I'm very blessed. You know, the good Lord is looking well after us. You know, my health is okay. And I believe at this stage of my life, what I have learned, what I've been so blessed in doing and learning by working to plow back in the region and to see if I can make a contribution.
And I'm sure you will continue to make a contribution. It's been a privilege. And Oberholzer, thank you very much for your time.
Thank you, Bronwyn.